So this physical review A of 2010 contains a lot of results that are used in our derivation. And you can find all the information, details of the derivation in these two references. So here's an outline of what I'm going to say. I will start by introducing the operational and probabilistic framework, which provides the language. This has already been done somehow by Lucien. Our framework is very similar to his. And anyway, it will be the language in which I will state the principles, so the six axioms that allow us to derive quantum theory. And I will try to sketch the proof, of course, in a non-technical way, because the two papers amount around 80 pages. So this will be just a flavor of what we did by some key results that lead from the axioms to the proof that the only theory singled out by the axiom is quantum theory. But let me start with some motivation, with a discussion about why do we want new axioms for quantum theory. Of course, it's a very successful theory. It explains a lot of physics, ranging from atomic physics to subnuclear processes. However, quantum theory has a problem that is counterintuitive. So this fact challenges our classical intuition and led to very strong debates in the history, in its history. And these debates are essentially related to the fact that we need an interpretation for an abstractly mathematical theory, which is in the standard course is presented as a theory in which systems are related to Hilbert spaces, states are vectors, observables are self-adjoint operators. So there's no conceptual physics in this presentation. And this is, in our opinion, the source of this, of the fact that the debate on foundation has been shifted for years on the interpretation. And a very important example is the EPR paradox and Bell theorem and the consequences of these two facts of quantum theory. Because, we can describe a spin with a semi-classical model, with many ad hoc hypotheses. However, Bell's theorem tells us that we cannot do the same when we want to describe a system which is composed by two one-half spins. And this attitude towards quantum theory, trying to get it back behind the fences of classical intuition, has been radically revolutionized by the advent of quantum information theory. And our work is in the course of this of the evolution of quantum information theory, clearly. And the idea is that what quantum information brought us is the idea that we don't want to explain the quantum effects, but we want to use them. So if they go beyond our imagination, they can be useful maybe to do tasks that go beyond our imagination. And so, for example, teleportation came out, or dense coding, key distribution, just to mention the tasks that come exactly from the EPR states, and many others, of course. And so in this line, we think that we can find physical axioms that have this informational interpretation. So we can raise some of these nice theorems of quantum information to the rank of axiom, and derive the theory from this concept. Having a conceptual basis for the theory, as Giulio already expressed in his introduction, would be very useful also to help quantum theory to face the challenges that come from field theory or gravity, as also Lucien was pointing out. So we are looking for physical axioms, and physical concepts are operationally defined. That's at least what we learn in first year courses at university. And so we would like to have axioms that are stated in an operational language. Then, since we don't have anything against mathematics, and quantum theory is a beautiful mathematical theory, of course these axioms will be translated later into the mathematical language. And it turns out that a very useful setting for formulating the axioms is using the information processing capabilities of the theory. So the information processing capabilities of physical processes. And this is exactly the way in which we formulate quantum mechanics, quantum theory, by stating which are the information some of the key information processing tasks that the theory should allow for. So I will very briefly go through the introduction of the operational language, because also Lucien spent some time on that. And the basic notion that we use is the notion of test. The test is depicted as a box. It has two wires, an input wire and an output wire. And it is used to build complex circuits that describe experiments that we can do in the labs. And the test is a collection of possible events labeled by an index, which is the outcome of the test, of the measurement in the end. And we can use this box also to denote the single event. So we will use this ambiguity, which is a very slight abuse, but can be very useful. We have labels that label the wires, the input wire and the output wire. And this will play the role of the systems. And they are the composition rules for our tests. So these are the rules that allow us to construct well-defined experiments. So we can connect two boxes in a sequence, constructing the new test, whenever the output label of the first box coincides with the input label of the second box, as here or there. As you see, I use also some boxes which have a special shape here, here and there. These are what we call preparation tests or observation tests. And they have a special input or output system, which is the trivial system, denoted by I, capital I. And the corresponding events are preparation events or observation events. And finally, as you see, I use also boxes with two wires, two input, two output wires. This is because we also want to introduce the composition of systems. Of course, whenever we have a couple of systems, A and B, we can construct the composite system C, which is the composition of A and B. Composition is commutative. And it has also these two properties, that it's associative. And when we compose a system with the trivial system, the system A remains unchanged. Finally, I want to introduce a special test, which is a unique event that I denote by IA. And this has the property that when I compose it in a sequence with an event, CI here, either before CI or after it, it leaves anyway it unchanged. And once we have the identity test, we can define reversible tests, which are deterministic tests, tests with a single outcome, such that there exists another one which can be composed with it either before or after and gives the identity, either on the input system or on the output system. And finally, this is the last primitive that I want to introduce in the operational framework. It's coarse graining or refinement. Whenever we have a test with a set of outcomes, we can produce these joint partitions of the set of outcomes and produce another test which correspond to the merging corresponding to this partition of the outcomes. This is a very natural thing that we can do in the labs. And what we get is another test. So we know that to each test there corresponds all the possible partitions and coarse grainings of the test. And of course we also have the inverse process, which brings from a coarse grain test to a more refined one, which we call refinement. So on top of this operational language, we have a probabilistic structure. And the essential assumption for the probabilistic structure is that tests from the trivial system to the trivial systems are probability distributions. So this implies that, for example, if we compose a preparation test and an observation test, what we get is a probability distributions a joint probability distribution of the outcomes. And more generally, when we have a huge network that anyway is closed, so the initial system and the final system are the trivial system, This big network corresponds to a joint probability distribution for all the outcomes that can appear in these boxes. So just a remark, deterministic theories are just a special case of probabilistic ones. So we can also include in our description theories in which the probabilities are either 0 or 1. This structure immediately allows us to construct equivalent classes of preparations and of observations that are the ones that give the same probabilities for all the tests that we connect to it. And then we can construct these classes, which are states in the case of preparations and effects in the case of observations. And since they are defined as functions, real-valued functionals on each other, they are very naturally endowed with a vector space structure. And we denote these two spaces by these two symbols. Of course, since we have spaces, we have a dimension. And systems have naturally a dimension, which is the dimension of this space. Notice that in the quantum case, this dimension would be the square of the dimension of the Hilbert space, because this is the dimension of the space of Hermitian matrices, Hermitian operators. And also, very naturally, once we have this structure, we can conclude that events are represented by linear transformations. And coarse graining, then, in this case, is just the sum of the events that are merged in the same outcome. And finally, the probabilistic structure allows us to define atomic transformations that are the ones that lie in an equivalence class that doesn't allow for any refinement. In the case of states, we call pure events, atomic events, pure states. And if a state is not pure, we call it mixed. And we call it fully mixed if every state, when we collect all the states that can refine it, then they span the whole state space. So in convex terms, these three terms have a very intuitive representation. A pure state is an extremal point, a mixed state is a non-extremal point, and a fully mixed state is one that lies in the internal face of the convex set. So now we have the background that is needed to formulate the principles. Before listing them, let me say some more words about how we think the principle should be. So first of all, they are operational. So they will be the expression of possibility or impossibility to do some operation. And the operation is defined by probabilities that they allow for. For example, if you take a statement like the no-cloning theorem, this would be a good operational principle because we can define the cloning operation by equality of these two probabilities. So a transformation would be a cloning if it would provide this equality. And just the principle is the negation of the possibility of doing such an operation. So no cloning is not one of our principles. So now I will go to the presentation of the six ones. The first one is causality. And this was already introduced somehow by Lucien. So let me just read the statement. The probability of operations is independent of preparations, is independent of the choice of observations. So this means that we cannot have backwards signaling from outputs to inputs. Because take, for example, the composition of a preparation test and an observation test, and then marginalize on the outcomes at the observation, what we get is a probability distribution for the outputs in the preparation test. Of course, this marginal could depend on the choice of test that I did here. And this would mean that by changing the test that I do, I can change the probability distribution for the preparation and then communicate some information backwards. And the principle forbids this. Causality says that this probability does not depend on the choice of test. So equivalently, it can be formulated as uniqueness of the deterministic effect. So whatever is the test, the observation test that I do, when I do a full coarse graining, I get always the same effect, which is the deterministic one and is unique. And this also allows to define a unique marginalization of states. Because when I take the deterministic effect composed with a state locally on one system, I get a unique marginal state. And one thing that I would like to stress is that causality implies that we cannot have signaling. So in order to have communication from one system to another, we need an interaction. So this is somehow exactly the notion of causality that is in special relativity. But you will see more on this on Friday when Maurer will introduce, will deliver his talk. So let us go to the second principle, which is local discriminability. If two bipartite states are different, they give different probabilities for at least one product experiment. So in pictures, suppose that we have two different states, then we can generate two different probabilities with local measurements, local effects. And this principle is the source of the tensor product structure for the state space of composite systems. Also, this principle is equivalent to the maybe more well-known principle of local tomography. Whenever we have a non-local state involving many systems, we can reconstruct it by local measurements. So somehow this principle reconciles the possibility of having non-locality hidden in the states, like the non-locality coming from entanglement, with a reductionist approach in which we think that we can reconstruct relevant information about the system just with local measurements. So we don't need to measure the whole universe to know something about a single system. Then we have atomicity of the composition, which is the sequential composition of two atomic operations is atomic. So this seems maybe a strange principle. Whenever we have two atomic events, we connect them and we build another atomic one. But maybe to accept this principle, it's better to negate it and see what happens. It may happen that we have a full knowledge of two events, connect them to build a composite event, a sequence of events. And if we have full knowledge of these two component events, still we don't have full knowledge of this piece of history. So this would be very strange because, of course, it's against our intuition, and I think this makes the principle reasonable. So perfect distinguishability is the fourth principle. Every state that is not completely mixed can be perfectly distinguished from some other state. So let us take a state rho, which is not completely mixed. Then we can find another state sigma such that, and the test, binary test, A not A1, such that the test gives rise to these probabilities. So this is the definition of perfect discrimination of sigma and rho. Of course, this is a principle that allows to state falsifiable propositions, propositions that have probabilities either 0 or 1, which is which was not present in the if we just kept the previous principle. And also, it is a principle that allows us to use physical systems to encode bits. So, because, of course, if we can perfectly discriminate two states, we can use one to encode 0 and the other one to encode 1. So it is also somehow a principle that allows to recover the logic and truth values in a completely probabilistic framework like the one that I introduced. Of course, this will not be the classical logic. It will be the quantum logic. And you will see in the following also the lattice of projections coming out of this principle along with others. Then the fifth principle is efficient lossless compression. For every state, there exists an ideal compression scheme. So in order to explain this principle, I first have to explain what is a compression scheme. Suppose that we have a state rho. A compression is a transformation from a system A, of which rho is a state, to another system C, such that it has the two properties of being lossless and efficient. So lossless means that there's also a decoding transformation that allows to recover every state that refines rho. So whenever we apply the encoding to a state that refines rho, we can recover the state with a decoding transformation D. And it must be efficient in the sense that there's no state of system C that is not the encoding of some state in the refinement set of row. So we don't have extra states that are not used for this purpose. In this sense, it's efficient. And also, this is the statement that allows us to say that somehow the system C is smaller than system A, because it contains no more states than A, for sure, because if the refinement set of row coincides with all the state space of A, then the set of states of C is exactly equal to the set of states of A. And on the other hand, if it's smaller, then system C has less states than system A. So to have a picture of what this principle states, we can consider quantum theory. And for example, in quantum theory, the system C is just a set of states on the support of a state row. So take, for example, this Q-treed state, then the compression is just the projection on this subspace, which is a qubit. So compression implies that every phase of our convex set is equivalent to another system, a smaller system. So the phases are, for example, in a polytope are segments. Whenever we have a state on a segment, the segment corresponds to the state space of some other system. And finally, we have the purification principle. I highlighted it in red because it's the one that singles out quantum theory in the range of theories that is delimited by the other principles, in which also classical probability theory lies, and possibly many other theories that we still don't know. And the statement of the purification postulate is the following. Every state has a purification, and for a fixed purifying system, every two purifications of the same state are connected by a reversible transformation. Then, in pictures, maybe it's easier. Suppose that we have a state, and we have a... there's always a bipartite pure state, such that its margin is equal to the state row. And if we have two different states, psi rho and psi prime rho, with the same property, then there exists a reversible transformation that connects those two states locally on the purifying system. So purification has many consequences, and we wrote more than 40 pages on the consequences of purification. But here I will illustrate just a few ones, the ones that are strictly necessary to go to the proof that quantum theory is singled out. So the first one is that we can simulate any process by a reversible transformation on a system with an ancilla which is prepared in a pure state, and then just followed by a measurement on the ancillary systems. And notice that I wrote these two sentences here because, well, now I will explain why, but the sentences are the following. So not necessarily irreversibility stems from marginalization. So this means that we can simulate every irreversible process by another one. This does not mean that necessarily in real life, whenever we have an irreversible process, this is due to the fact that we have a reversible interaction and we are forgetting some system. But on the other hand, in principle, we can include any purifying system in the physical description. So why I state these two sentences? Just to say that the purification postulate is interpretation free. So whether you believe in many words or in spontaneous decoherence, so this principle still fits your philosophical framework for quantum theory. And a very important consequence of purification is probabilistic teleportation. So as a consequence of purification, we know that there exists a state and a bipartite state and a bipartite effect such that their connection is probabilistically equivalent to the identity. So we can teleport a state from here to there. And the probability of this teleportation is smaller than the inverse of the dimension. And using teleportation, we can also prove the Choi isomorphism. This is widely used in quantum information theory. This is a one-to-one correspondence between effects, between transformations, and bipartite states. And the correspondence is very easily obtained by applying locally the transformation to what is called a fateful state, which is the state used for teleportation, for example. And this is very important because this correspondence is important because it says that whenever we have two theories with purifications, and the theories have the same sets of states for every system, then they must be the same, because also the transformations are the same. And the reason is that transformations, in the end, just turn out to be states of a bipartite system. So this is crucial for our derivation, because we will just have to prove that the states of our theory are just quantum states. If we succeed in this, we know that also the transformations are completely positive maps. So we are done. And an important result is the correspondence between pure states and atomic effect, which is the first postulate by Lucien. And so the statement is quite clear now. For every pure state, there exists a unique atomic effect such that the pairing of the state and the effect is equal to one. And this is in particular the effect that allows to discriminate the pure state whenever we have some set of perfectly discriminable states, including it. And this theorem seems to bring us towards what is called in convex set theory self-duality, or weak self-duality. However, it's not completely true. We will get weak self-duality just after having further results that I will show you here. Let me just say that the correspondence is also works also in the opposite direction. For every atomic effect, there exists a unique pure state such that the pairing is equal to one. So, using all these results and other technical theorems that I didn't mention, we can prove that whenever we have a maximal set of perfectly distinguishable states, then this set has the same, all these sets have the same cardinality. So the cardinality of such a set is a characteristic of our system, which we call discriminability dimension, which is lowercase d sub a, which is different from capital D sub a. And there's a relation between the two that I will show you shortly. But just to remind you what is a maximal set of perfectly distinguishable states, it's a set such that the states are perfectly distinguishable, but whenever I append whatever state to this set, I spoil this condition of perfect distinguishability. Of course, in general, in theory, you are not granted that such sets all have the same cardinality. So this is a tricky but important result. And also, as a consequence of this, we have spectral decomposition. Actually, here I show it for states. So for every state, there is a maximal set of perfectly distinguishable pure states, such that the state is a convex combination of such distinguishable states. But the same holds, thanks to the state and effect correspondence, for elements of the real span of effect. So this is exactly the spectral theorem for Hermitian operators in quantum theory. As you see, every element of this real span can be decomposed as a combination with real coefficient of perfectly discriminating observation tests, which in the quantum case are projections on pure states. And the relation of dimensions that I mentioned before comes from the teleportation scheme, because we can independently prove two theorems. The first one is that this probability is the inverse of capital D, and the other theorem is that this probability is equal to the inverse of the square of lowercase d. And then we can conclude that this is the relation of the two dimensions. This is very important because once we realize that capital D is a square integer, we know that we can represent states not only as vectors, but as particular vectors that are matrices. So square real matrices, or equivalently Hermitian matrices, complex Hermitian matrices. So it seems that we are already in at a good point, but actually I could tell you that proving that these matrices should be positive is as tough as proving this. So this is the remaining part. One easy thing to do, somehow easy thing to do using some results in group theory, is that for the discriminability dimension equal to 2, the set of states is a sphere, like the Bloch sphere, and the action of reversible transformations on such systems is a conjugation with some element of the group SU2, or even U2. So this is essentially a qubit. We still don't have the completely positive maps of qubits, but we are sure that the state space is a sphere, like the Bloch sphere, and that this is the action of reversible transformations. Then we have to define projections. So projections are related to the compression postulate, because, as I told you, we have phases that are somehow related to subsystems. And for a phase containing a state row, I can also associate a phase that I call F perpendicular row, which is the phase that contains all the states that are perfectly distinguishable from row. These are two complementary phases somehow, and I can define a projection, which is a transformation with these two properties. So this definition is enough, thanks to our postulates, to prove the uniqueness of such a transformation. And these projections are somehow the lattice of projections of quantum logic, as I mentioned before. And using projections, and of course also other lemmas, we can prove somehow what we call the superposition principle. So take a probability distribution with cardinality equal to the dimension of the discriminability dimension of the system, and take any perfectly distinguishing observation test. You can think of this as a property of the system, because it perfectly distinguishes the maximal number of discriminable states. But we can prove that there is always a pure state, such that when we measure this property on the state, we get the probability distribution. And this works for every probability distribution. This means that for whatever is some property that you want to associate to the system, there is a superposition of different properties. Then, using this theorem, we can also prove that we can construct a state which, as a choice state, would represent a reversible transformation between any two systems with the same dimension. This implies that this transformation exists, and this means that for every couple of systems with the same dimension, we know that they are equivalent. So now we know that we have two numbers, that in the end is just one number, which is this lowercase d, which completely characterizes the set of states of the system. And, okay, when we want to prove that the states of a higher dimensional system are qubits, we use the projections, indeed. And we know that the matrix representing the state is a Hermitian matrix with, of course, many elements. But projecting on three-dimensional spaces, we know that these matrices must be positive. And then doing this on every diagonal, every principal three-by-three submatrix, we can prove that the whole matrix must be positive. So the tricky point here is that I use the Q-treat instead of the qubit. So you will wonder how we pass from the qubit to the Q-treat. This is a technical part that I didn't want to discuss because it involves some group theory and mathematics, which is not particularly interesting for the purpose of this talk. But let me just say that using our theorem of sufficiency of states, and having this result, that the d-dimensional system has qubit states, we can prove that the theory is indeed quantum theory. Because, as I showed you before, this implies that also the transformations of states are completely positive maps. So, just to conclude, I showed you six axioms. And as I told you in the introduction, they just refer to concepts from the operational probabilistic framework, and they do not have any mathematical elements in their statement. So these are, from this point of view, these are conceptual actions. Maybe they are not crisp, and maybe they don't steer your soul as Chris or Gilles would have liked, but they work. And we did not check for simplifications or dependencies in the set of axioms, and neither we cared about having a small number of them. Just what was important for us was to have an operation, a completely operational and conceptual formulation of quantum theory. So that's all. Thank you.
We have lots of time for questions. Let me start with the first hand. You don't sit closer.
That they work, the fact that they work is an awfully good start.
Thank you.
So I'm interested in the fact that you have to use the Q-treat instead of the qubit. Can you explain very simply what additional properties a Q-treat has that enable you to do this kind of construction?
Well, this is just a technical point, but if you have a Q-treat, you have a phase relation between these three elements. Whereas if you had just a qubit, you knew that the phase of this element could be arbitrary. So you don't have any fixed phase relation between of diagonal elements. The qubit doesn't help you in this purpose. That's all.
So I have a question about the purification postulate, which I understand it's pretty important in this construction. So is it important that this purification is limited to finite dimensional systems? Because I think, if I understand well, I could purify classical probabilities as well. But typically, I will need to infinite dimensional systems. So, for example, if I have a box and it's divided in two and the particle can be to the left or to the right, I can purify these to, if I understand well what purification means, to some deterministic variables, which is the position of the particle in the box. I'm not sure if I understand, if maybe it's not that the purification, but I want to ask if... what makes it that it is true in quantum mechanics and not in classical physics?
Okay. So let me just... pick this picture. So this is not the purification you're referring to. So the purification you're referring to is somehow related to the existence of a completely deterministic hidden variable. So I can describe my probability distribution just saying that the... probabilistic descriptions comes from my ignorance, but there's a pure state underlying it. This is not the same purification we define here. Here we say that for every state of system A, there exists another system A tweedle and a bipartite pure state of the two, such that the marginal state is equivalent to the starting one. So this is not the case for classical probability distributions. If I have a bipartite classical probability distribution, a classical pure state would be the product of two pure states. So the marginal is always pure. In this sense, this doesn't work in classical theory.
One should realize that when starting with the pictorial language, one actually already brings in a whole lot of axioms implicitly. One example, for example, which people have considered is quaternionic quantum mechanics. This is already excluded because you actually are bringing in a bunch of axioms on the tensor product structure purely by starting to draw these diagrams. And they actually exclude quaternionic quantum mechanics from the start, because they violate certain axioms which the tensor product in Hilbert spaces satisfies.
So let me understand. I guess that you saw behind these pictures a categorical approach. And of course, this is true. So that the rules that I specified for the boxes are in the end the axioms of a symmetric monoidal category. But it's not clear to me that the tensor product structure is ruled out by this. So maybe
I say quaternionic quantum mechanics, for example, which is something people have considered a long time ago and more recently, is already excluded just by drawing the pictures.
Okay.
So one should realize that one is bringing in a lot of postulates there too. If one is fair, one should consider them as part of the postulates,
yes,
which is about how you compose systems and things like that.
Okay.
They do already exclude things which people have considered as a reasonable attempt for a foil theory, say quaternionic quantum mechanics or something like that, which is fairly well developed.
Uh-huh. I see. So essentially you're saying that whenever I define the operational language, I introducing implicitly some
action. Yes.
But
yes,
this is, I think this is true, but this is common to all the axiomatizations. There's a certain level that I call the background, and then something that I state as an axiom on top of this. But this is, of course, not a mathematical axiomatization of the theory. These are the axioms on top of this operational background.
Do you have something specific to say about where complex numbers arise in your axiomatization?
Yes, that's essentially what I told before. So the point is that once you realize that the dimension of the state space is a square integer, you can arrange the state the vector representing the state in a square, real square matrix. But there's a one-to-one correspondence between real square matrices and complex Hermitian matrices, and that's where the complex number stem from.
So let me ask a question. To what extent does what I'm about to say characterize the purification postulate well? It seemed to me you were saying something like this. So if I thought of it at the level of maps, so for any map on some system, I can think of that as a reversible map on a larger mm-hmm. system. You can think of it as it's a kind of consistency principle that anything you're going to avail yourself of as sort of treated externally, like rolling dice and doing whatever you want, can always be modeled within the theory itself.
Yes. This comes from almost immediately if you allow for probabilities that are different from 0 or 1 and from causality. So you can use some set of experiments which you know by causality are independent from the next one to roll the die. So I don't think that this should be pictured as a purification. It's just a justification of the mixing. But I think that to a good extent this is a purification in the proper sense that we introduced. You can always use pure experiments to simulate any generation of probabilities.
And what exactly did you mean by it's interpretation independent?
Well, it's just the fact that it's just a way to say that we are not ruling out, for example, spontaneous decoherence. There may be a physical process that is essentially decoherent, and the probability doesn't come from your ignorance of some purifying system which you're discarding, but it's just there. It's intrinsic. So we are not. I just wanted to say that we are not ruling out this. We just say that we can, whenever we have such a process, we can use another perfectly reversible one with pure states that perfectly simulates this one. And but on the other hand, we are not ruling out many words. So, of course, purification is very compatible with this interpretation. That's it.
Okay, if there are no other questions. I have sorry, Lucien, do you want?
I like the axioms tremendously and the work behind them. I think one thing that people don't appreciate just seeing the axioms is how much work there is behind them. And as I said, I borrowed from that work in my own uh-huh. recent work. The the purification axiom kind of disturbs me a little bit, because I think although it may be interpretation independent, it heavily suggests that we should move in the direction of many worlds. And I've long time been a sort of anti-advocate of many worlds. So, I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you think, you said it's not inconsistent. Actually, it sort of very naturally suggests that if you wanted to believe that there's a reason for that purification postulate, then isn't the reason that the world is as described by Everett?
Well, the principle could be considered as a principle of conservation of information. So, I'm not saying that I want to believe in conservation of information. I'm just saying that most physicists want to believe in it. So this was, for example, this was the reason for the argument between Penrose and Hawking and Susskind about the non-unitarity of the dynamics of black holes and things like that. But I don't share your opinion that the purification postulate seems to point in the direction of conservation of information. So it may be, but as well it may just be a postulate of simulability. I can simulate something where information is lost with some other process in which it's conserved. So if you interpret the principle in this way, it's neutral from the point of view of interpretation. But anyway, let me just do a remark to your point. So it's quantum theory that seems to point toward many worlds, I think, not our particular formulation. I don't believe in many worlds, I have to admit.
Okay.
I just have one question of clarification. You said that your axiomatization does not exclude the possibility of having like collapse models. So if you would have a theory that forbids preparation of pure states, for example, it allows only preparations of mixed states beginning from some size, whatever it means, would this be in contradiction with the purification postulate?
Well, as I told to in my previous answer, I wouldn't say, because whenever the theory works, it means that if I could prepare pure state, I could simulate this with pure state. Then the fact that I cannot produce pure states is an empirical fact, but this does not change the theory. The theory deals with idealized situations, of course. It's not clear that you can prepare perfectly pure states in a lab.
Okay, I have an announcement to make, but let's start by thanking Paolo again for his talk.